this is Kay Ballard, and I want to welcome you to Women Are Not Funny Radio, the show that thoroughly understands and embraces its own premise. Now, as you know, because I told you last week, recently an expert at broadcasting told me that you would have no patience for me unless in the first 20 seconds I told you three fascinating things that you would learn in the show. And if I don't do that, you'll be right out the door. Well, this was truly an industry expert who gave me this advice, but I protested because I know there is very little that you will learn on the show. You see, I am no longer devoted to education. In fact, I'm just done with it. I don't want to learn anything, and I want you to play hooky with me. That's the truth. But according to that expert, and she truly is an expert, you will have absolutely none of that. So here we go. I'll do the best I can. Today's show is truly international, and we love that. We have a very seasoned traveler who does her travel from the vantage point of what we in the States and in Europe so arrogantly refer to as down under, the other side of the earth. She is from Sydney, Australia, and what she's going to be talking with me about today is the nature of travel, and specifically to very interesting trips that she's had in the past year to Asia. We're also going to talk about her very unusual career and enter into something of an intellectual conversation about the best way to overcome resistance. Now, here's what I also want you to know. Our featured guest has a beautiful voice. You're going to like it much better than mine. But please keep in mind, she's been working on her voice for many, 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 many more years than me. I'm certain of it. So, Lynn Walsh, you've listened to this show. God love you. So you know how I have to bring you on. I have two questions for you that I must know the answer to. I have to know, are you using this appearance on Women Are Not Funny Radio as a stepping stone to something better?
Am I using this appearance as a stepping stone to something better? I couldn't get any better than being on Women Are Not Funny Radio. It's I'm an avid listener, and why would I not, you know, feel like my career had ended by at this zenith?
Well, Lynn, you can imagine I love that answer, and I'm sure it was totally sincere. But here's the other thing I have to know, and it's not because I'm paranoid. I'm simply not paranoid, but you do have that lovely voice. Everyone who hears it comments on how they love your voice. Are you here actually auditioning to take over my show?
Well, there's something I haven't shared with you, Kay. My father was actually a radio announcer. It was the first job that he ever had. And I am sometimes mistaken for a man when I answer the phone at home. So read into that what you will.
Well, here's the truth. I am nervous, and I think that is coming through. You know, I'm going to do everything I can to persuade you that your current career is fulfilling enough and you really do not need to take over my radio show. But, you know, I do understand that you have that genetic call, if you will, to be on the radio. You know, while I'm thinking about it, you are aware, of course, as a regular listener, that Women Are Not Funny is currently having a win a date with Hugh Jackman contest. Do you think you so how well do you know him?
I don't know him at all. I know he is very happily married to another Australian actor, Deborah Furness, but that probably never got in the way of having a date with him, I guess. He grew up very close to where I live in the northern suburbs of Sydney, so I wouldn't say no if I was a listener and had that opportunity. Have you actually spoken to Hugh Jackman?
Oh, goodness, no. See, that's why I need your help. You know, we have the contest. We have everything. We have everything for the contest except him. We don't have him.
Okay.
But I thought, you know, I thought since you are from Australia, it was likely that you knew him. And also, probably one of the reasons I was thinking that you knew Hugh Jackman is, as I understand it, you used to date Errol Flynn, too. You know, is that true?
The closest I can go to that is that I've just come back from a weekend in Tasmania where he was born, and I did notice you inferred that I'd been working on my voice for many, 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 many more years than you had on yours, and I'll just leave that one there because I'll let the listeners decide who's closer to the truth on that one.
Oh, listen, Errol Flynn, regardless of your age, he is a man of legend. And I just assumed that you had dated him, but maybe not, you know. I mean, do you find him attractive?
No.
Really?
Perhaps when the green tights, the Robin Hood, perhaps in those days, but no.
Well, you know, speaking of these legendary men, and speaking of getting a hit in, this morning I was confronted by a direct message from you that said something really rather unkind about the Lone Ranger, you know, about having a nightmare about the Lone Ranger. And I'm going, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness, why would she, you know, just because I play Rossini at the opening of this show? Interesting.
I was preparing myself for this wonderful appearance, and as you know, I'm a regular listener to your show, and I don't know, the hi-ho silver thing kept waking me up in fits of nerves, but I'm settled now, and I think I'm ready for whatever comes my way.
I'm just being mean to suggest that you dated Errol Flynn. You know, he died in 1959. You know, and you were probably no older than 30 then, right?
Yes, Kate.
You know, just guessing here. I don't know. Anything about it, but there are things I do know, and obviously for me it's been very cool to have you as a friend, and particularly to have a friend who actually lives in Sydney, Australia. But one of the things that crosses my mind is that there are some little known facts about Australia that, you know, you probably are unaware of. You know, they're little known. They should be known, but they're not. And so I thought, you know, I'd help you out by kind of going through them.
Please do.
All right, here is the first fact about Australia, is that I own an Aboriginal painting.
Wonderful.
That's a fact about Australia. Did you know that? Did you know? Are you aware that Virginia actually has a museum devoted to Aboriginal art? It's called the Kluge Roo, and it's at the University of Virginia. And so that's where I bought my painting. And I am an art collector, and one of the things that it's a dot painting is actually what it is. Do you like them?
I do. I enjoy Indigenous art very much. In fact, we have three pieces ourselves, one of which is a dot or a sand painting, as they're called, and other ones which are more of the hashed line variety and come from Arnhem Land in the east of the Northern Territory. Beautiful pieces.
Yeah. Oh, I love the hash ones. Mine's a dot, and mine is actually quite small, but it's still very dear to me, and I really enjoy it. I think people are surprised when they learn that it's actually contemporary art. You know, it's not, they a lot of times think that it is from the distant past or something, that style of painting, but it's really not, as you, I'm sure you know. Okay, here's another fact about Australia. It's kind of related. I once went to an exhibit of Aboriginal art at the National Geographic, which was across the street from my office when I was foundation executive in downtown Washington, D.C. That's another little known fact about Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a museum show at lunch.
That's right. At lunchtime, was it? A short visit.
Would you agree that
in which you were, in which you were there, as you were
what?
In the first known fact about little known fact about Australia, you feature in both of those little known facts about Australia.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a little known fact about Australia. Okay, here's another little known fact about Australia. I own a pair of Birkenstocks. It's a limited edition pair. It's clog style, and it has Aboriginal art, on the clogs. And I ordered them from Germany, limited edition. That's another little known fact about Australia.
You'll forgive me if I don't sort of lock these into my brain as important things to know.
you don't see these for the important.
Well, I'm sure they will find a place in my head to stay, but I'm not sure where and how.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you have any others?
Yeah, oh, I do. All right. I once read The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes about the founding of Australia.
Oh, okay. Yep.
That's another little known.
A very good time to have read.
Yeah.
I too have read it. I have a convict ancestor. I have two convict ancestors.
Apparently, that doesn't make you special.
No. People did everything they could to hide it, and these days people aren't too fussed about the fact that they did, but I'm excited by it because I just love the story, particularly of my ancestor, one of them who was 16 years old when she was transported out here for receiving stolen goods. And the more interesting fact about her that I find fascinating is that she had tattoos on both her arms, self-inflicted ones.
Come on. Well, it would be rather sad, I think, to be an Australian and not have any convicts as ancestors. It would just be a sad thing. And don't you think?
I don't know. I know many happy people who don't. And as you'd be aware, much like the United States, Australia is a country which has in the past and hopefully in the future welcomed migrant populations, so they would have different stories to tell. That's what I like about the place. It's the diversity.
Well, that, you know what, that is really very interesting to me. And it shows that there are different ways of defining diversity, because one of the things that really surprised me, and obviously I'm just reading about it, I don't really know, you will know. And, you know, despite the fact that I did go to that art exhibit at the National Geographic, you know, at lunchtime a dozen or so years ago, there are still just a few things I don't know about Australia, having never been there. But what I read in preparation for this conversation with you, Lynn, is that the population of Australia is just very much skewed in favor of European descent. Is that not true?
That is true.
Like maybe over 90%.
Oh, I don't know the numbers, but it could well be so.
When you talk about diversity, you're talking about diversity of backgrounds.
Yes, and I guess living in Sydney, it's a very different place to some other parts of the country where it is less diverse. So the bigger cities will have more diverse populations.
Well, one of the things that I read that was so impressive to me was that you have a very high literacy rate, that if you live in Australia, you're going to learn to read, for sure.
Well, one hopes so, and I guess these things are all relative, and there are always people who are missing out on those opportunities, but, relatively speaking, compared to the rest of the world, we do very well.
The claim is that you have a 99% literacy rate, which is astounding. But, you know, one of the things that I was trying to do with my little known facts about Australia was to, of course, make fun of myself for being so self-absorbed. But it also is about my observation that we try from a distance to learn about another country, another culture, another continent, but sometimes it just boils down to these iconic representations that come to our minds when we think of that other country, culture, or in your case, continent. So, you know, I have never been to Australia. I would like to go there, you know, when I can handle a 20-hour flight. I tell you what, it's never been on my short list. It's moved up quite a few notches since I met you and became friends with you. But, you know, my iconic list is Crocodile Dundee, the Sydney Opera House, Koala Bears and Kangaroos. You know, what do you think about that? And the thing that is very interesting to me is that if I were to go there, I would do things to reinforce those images. You know, I would definitely want to go to the Sydney Opera House. I would want to see the animals. And I also would want you to hook me up with some kind of, you know, growly Aussie guy wearing khaki, you know.
I love the way you say khaki, as we would say it, khaki. It is interesting the way we have these symbols of places, particularly those that we haven't been to. And as you say, when we come to the place, we want to reinforce or see those and somehow reinforce them. I've been fortunate enough to visit your country a few times, and I always zero back to some of the things that I love to do, particularly in New York City, which I'm an urbanophile, if there's such a word. Since studying urban geography at university many years ago, when Errol Flynn was a student there, I've really just been excited by big cities. And And so, of course, when you go to New York, you have to visit the Statue of Liberty, and you have to go up to the Empire State Building, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're fortunate enough to have the ability and the time to either stay longer or to revisit a place, that's when you can get a little deeper in and understand more But it's always only ever a snapshot. It's only ever a slice and an impression. It's never the whole. And I can't pretend to even know everything about the city I'm currently living in or the country I live in. So wherever you are, it's what you're experiencing and reinforcing whatever is going on in your head.
Well, you make a very good point there. And I know, you know, your trips to the States have been for both business and pleasure. You've actually worked here running meetings for as a consultant, I think, for an ongoing contract for a company here. But you also have come here for recreation. But tell us a little bit about these two, in my view, lengthy trips to Asia that you took this year. One was a return trip to the People's Republic of China, and one was to Cambodia.
Yes. Well, the return trip to China was a shorter trip. It was our fourth visit. My husband and I travel together as often as we can. And the China trip was something that we had to do because many years ago when our children were small, we were backpacking. We were on a quite a long trip. It took us 3 or 4 months, and we traveled literally around the world and found ourselves getting on a public boat going down the Yangtze River because we wanted to go through the Three Gorges before that gigantic dam was built. And not knowing the language, and those years ago, not as many people in China spoke English, so it was a bit tricky, but we managed to be quite proud of ourselves that we'd gotten onto this boat, and we had a cabin, and travelling down, we just hadn't banked on the fact that the boat wouldn't stop, and we travelled through the most scenic parts of the gorge at 2 o'clock in the morning, which was, as you can imagine, not very useful for seeing the landscape. So this was a revisit, and despite the fact that the river is now only a matter of metres away from being at its fullest, we still did manage to go and see and imagine what the landscape may have been, but it's still a very beautiful country. And also we got to see the extent of the infrastructure project that is that massive dam that's relocated so many people up into higher ground. So that was the main purpose for that visit, and it was quite wonderful. That and food, which is a big magnet for us.
But Lynn, how many years between that visit and the last one?
That was 11 and 16. I think there were differences. Yes, we'd been there 11 years ago, but also 16 years prior, and mm-hmm. the differences in the country were quite staggering.
Oh, I'm sure.
China is from an economic perspective and a growth perspective is coming ahead in leaps and bounds, and industrially and buildings, and even noticing the difference in people and their size. The nutrition is clear, you know, people are clearly becoming more urban, and all that comes from that. I'm not an analyst on any of the facts of it. I just sort of was experiencing some differences in the experience of us being there at a relatively short time ago.
Exactly. It's something that I've read a good bit about, but I really don't even have the ability to imagine it, I must say. And then more recently, actually a short time ago, you had a 2-week trip to Cambodia. And the first thing I want to know is, why Cambodia? How did you decide to go there?
We've been to Vietnam before, and one of our daughters had traveled with her friends fairly recently and visited Cambodia and Laos, and she was most keen for us to go there, particularly knowing how her father really enjoys sort of getting out and into some interesting places that are a bit off the beaten track. So she was encouraging us to go on one of our next trips, and the major, we had 10 minutes to make a decision. I don't know what it's like in the States these days, but we have some extraordinarily cheap airfares become available from time to time if you just keep your eye out. And Rob found $99 one-way fares from Sydney to Ho Chi Minh City, which was a great stepping-off point. So with between that and some frequent flyer points, we managed to get across there and go and visit the amazing district of Angkor Wat and spend days wandering around the temples there. And so we spent some time in Siem Reap and also Phnom Penh.
That's just amazing. Amazing to me. Was that, where would you place this trip on the hierarchy of trips, if you will, that you've made? Was this one of the better ones or somewhere in between?
Oh, it's like your babies. You can't play favorites. I really did enjoy it. And again, the food, the friendliness of the people, the hospitality, particularly in Vietnam and Cambodia. These are people who've come through so many wars over time, and you could forgive them for being very cynical about all sorts of things, but they are such living the moment, friendly, hospitable people who that just can't help but rub off on you when you're traveling. So to that extent, it was also very relaxing. So and hot, make no mistake, hot and humid.
Well, you know what? You and I definitely have a different point of view concerning one thing about travel. I think you got a very short haircut in preparation for this trip, which was probably a smart thing to do. But I always take my hair with me, Lynn.
And so where do you put it when you take it with you?
It's just right there on my head. You know, it goes along with me. But one of the things that our listeners need to know is that the reason you are able to do this travel is because you are self-employed. You are you have your own company, and you are the principal. And the thing that you do is meeting facilitation. And as you pointed out to me, and I already knew this. In fact, I've kind of alluded to it. This career is capping off many, 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 many other careers. But, you know, as I look at your work history, you've done a lot of interesting things. It seems like to me you are, maybe the root of it is, you are interested in process. Would you agree with that?
Interested in process. Tomato, tomato.
Should I say process? Process?
It's we understand what each other means, and that's the important thing.
I actually would love to say process, but you know, people think I already sound pretentious enough, so you know that would come off as very pretentious here if I started saying process. But I would love that. You know, I'm thinking it over. Okay, so is my accusation accurate? Are you someone devoted to process, Lynn?
It's, I guess it's an interesting proposition, and I haven't really been asked this question in quite this way. I guess that's why people employ a facilitator in the first instance, to have somebody independently come in, and that's one of the elements that you can be helpful with in terms of suggesting and introducing activities and processes that may help people get to where they think they need to be. And oftentimes, let me put it this way, I work pretty much content-free in terms of I don't have a vested interest in the work and the content of the work that people are doing, which is one of the things that I really love about being a facilitator. It means I can, particularly a freelance one, you never know what you're going to get. There's such a variety in terms of what it is that people want to come together to do, or just to be and have some fun together, or just talk. So there's variety in the people, the organisations, the places that you get to work, the communities you get to work with. And you just need to be fairly flexible and have a whole lot of stuff, not just in your kit that you physically bring with you, but also, I guess, be prepared to be prepared for anything. And that's where, if you're looking at career paths, that's where if you look at facilitators, you'll never ever see somebody who said, when I grow up, I want to be a facilitator of workshops or meetings or whatever it is. People generally have had very wide and varied life experience, and it's what you bring, and then essentially you walk into the room as yourself and hope that you've done as much preparation to put yourself in a place that you can really work with the group and help them do what they need to do in a respectful and responsive, and something that I have to work very hard on in a relaxed way, you know, to just go with the flow.
Well, I'm constantly amazed by it when I think about it. And as we have discussed, we are both fortunate to be in a position to make our living by talking, you know, because when people pay you
to talk. As a speaker, you get to talk probably a lot more than I do, and that's well and truly a craft in itself.
Well, it's hard to know, though, because I've not seen you in action. Obviously, I've seen other people facilitate meetings, but one of the things that I had been really looking forward to is you, at one time, you were going to facilitate a meeting with Women Are Not Funny staff, and that was in a time period when we had a lot more people involved, and you were going to help us bring some process into how we made decisions about content and different segments on the show, and then help us bring some process, if you will, to our consideration of those issues and in the whole production. And it just never came about, but I was really, really looking forward to that, because I know that what you do, the way you've described it to me, you do know when you're doing your job well, when if you can step back and kind of be invisible to the process. But are you there, do you offer a critique, Lynn? Is that part of what you do? Do you step in when you see things going in the wrong way? How do you steer people? Is that something, do you have kind of a protocol, or do you do that based on the client's wishes?
Not necessarily on the client's wishes. You set up, the way I work, I like to set up with the client, get an idea of why, what's the purpose of the people coming together. And I always say to the client, once we've signed this off and we know where we're going, and I get a sense of how much what they might want to risk, if you like, and I always hope that they're coming together with a very open and honest approach, so that they're truly wanting people to voice their views and get involved. So it really depends. Sometimes you might step in if things are looking interesting, in inverted commas, to challenge or ask questions about what's going on. But other times, it's good not to even step in, even when some things are happening where people are needing to really get serious about what they're talking about, and to let people understand that there are times within conversations, particularly if there are issues that are really important to people and they're passionate about them, that they need to spend some time going through the hard discussion and seeing how they can come through that together rather than having somebody step in and say, whoa, you're doing it the wrong way. I mean, to do that would be to go against every facilitation bone in the body, from my perspective.
Do you, Lynn, do you facilitate company retreats?
Yes, I have done, yes.
So in that case, with that sort of task, is it the facilitator's job to help people connect?
Yes, and that would be, absolutely. And it's how you set it up, and not just about the physical surrounds, but to make the place a safe place and a place that people can be challenged in a way that they feel respected and able to contribute in whatever way that they feel comfortable, because you'll always have different people in the room. So it's about how you set the scene, if you like. Spend a reasonable amount of time at the front end of any get-together helping people sort of understand how they might be working together and how open they might want it to be. And not to have people feel like there's expectations and they have to walk out of there with something something on a piece of paper. Sometimes
so is what would you say? Is 30% of your work pre-planning that you do with a client? Is it
the conversations you have with the client at the beginning are very important to really understand what it is and what their expectations are. So I will often ask, if this has been a success for you, and success means different things to different people, but if this has been a success for you, what does it look like and feel like at the end of the 2 days, and what does it look and feel like 2 or 3 weeks later and a few months later? But oftentimes there might be some good short-term wins in terms of they've worked through an issue and finally made a decision on something, or oftentimes it will be simply because they've walked out of there and understood each other better, and perhaps some conflicts that may have been going on have been dissipated to some extent. So, yes, the expectations of the client are really important to talk through and work through. And then,
Lynn, do they ever play hide the ball? In other words, do they ever have an agenda that they don't reveal? Has that happened to you?
I am sure that happens many, many, many times. And the hope is that you set up processes in a way that reveals, helps people be honest with everyone about, and helps people have the courage to ask the questions of people who might have those hidden agendas. So, there's all that. So the one of the key roles of a facilitator is to pay attention to what's going on and to be able to throw the odd question in here and there that might reveal something, or to help people notice themselves what's going on. It's a really hard thing to unpack. Sometimes you just sort of be able to go in there and it happens. It just happens. I find it difficult to explain sometimes.
Yeah, you can't really take us behind the curtain, but I can tell you this. I am totally impressed that, it's not that I don't like spontaneity. I do. But in my career, I really don't like a lot of surprises. So when I was practicing law, I did estate planning. I had a boutique practice. My practice was limited to estate planning with people of a certain net worth, And I always knew in advance what my conversations were going to be, pretty much what they were going to be like and who they were going to be with. And I would be terrified to practice law in the way that many lawyers do, kind of like you described, where you never know who the next client is going to be, what they're going to be like, what they're going to need help with. I would have nightmares about that,
Never know what's going to emerge in a conversation. But you always got to keep people in choice. It's like almost having a menu so that people can choose to I mean, they're choosing to be in the room. Sometimes they're choosing to be in the room because they're being compliant with their organisation, and if they don't, then they feel there might be consequences. But if they're choosing to be in a room, you need to give the people choices as to how they might participate or not. And that's really important, because every person in the room will have reasons for the way that they're responding to something. And, going with the flow. But having said that, working within a legal framework or an engineering framework or computer technology, so often I work with IT people or and engineers, and the type of work that they do, for the majority of their work, needs to be very very specific, and they need to have very detailed plans about what they do. But then there's the people engagement stuff, which you can't sort of say this is how it's going to work. This is how the command and control style just doesn't wash anymore.
Well, no, absolutely. And I can relate on some level because I've done consulting, which, was really, for the most part, organizational development consulting. And so, some of what you are talking about would be experience that I can relate to. I think it was very good news to hear that your facilitation blog actually was the source of a recent client. And Lynn has been blogging, and it's a very interesting blog to me. A lot of what she's been writing lately has been book reviews. And Lynn, why don't you give the URL? There are certainly links on our show notes where you can click and go to her blog, but why don't you tell people your URL so they can leave us and go read your blog?
The URL is ontheplusside.com.au. So on the plus side, all of those words running in together, that's my business name, /WordPress.
Well, on the plus side could be a clothing shop.
It could be, and I do believe there are clothing shops by that name.
But anyway, it's a great name, and one of your posts gave me something that I wanted to talk about today. And you made the statement, and I think you're right. You said resistance is everywhere. Do you run into that with your clients? Do you run into resistance? Or are you just talking generally in our world?
Oh, I think we all tend to be resistant to levels of change, and we all want to feel like we're in some kind of level of control, and when somebody tries to sort of shift you one way, or when circumstances arise, you want to hold on to things that you're comfortable with. I think it pretty much is.
Do you think the fact that I am having a conversation with you about resistance on Women Are Not Funny Radio is an indication that I'm an intellectual?
Of course. And probably you didn't need any other indicators. You didn't even need that to ascertain that fact.
Right. I just would call myself that and then, deem it so. But I just wanted, to really kind of test the waters, see if I could get you to say I'm pretty deep.
Oh, I've never known someone so deep.
Thank you, Lynn. So one of the things that I noticed about your review, and I think it's unfair to call it a review totally, but you wrote about a book, The Answer to How is Yes, by an author named Peter Block. And one of the ways I know I'm deep is the first time I read it, I got it wrong. I totally missed your point. In fact, I thought you were making the opposite point. Okay? So then I came back to it and I read it again, and it wasn't your fault. It's totally because you're Australian, you have ancestors that are convicts, you are one of the 99% that is, clearly you're literate. If Australians are 99% literate, you must be among those that are. That's just what I think.
Yes.
Am I right about that? Okay, so you are literate and you spring from convicts, but you, the fact that I misunderstood what you wrote had nothing to do with your writing. It had to do with my reading. But then I went back and I realized what you wrote, and then I realized I disagreed with you. You know,
oh,
that's
good.
How I got confused. That's what I got confused in the first place, because you agreed with the author, you know. And let me see if I can state what I'm talking about here, because anyone listening won't have the slightest idea so far. So what the author said was that you shouldn't, when a question comes up or when something comes up, instead of going to the how question, how do I do it? How can I do it? How does this work? How will it happen? You should go first, you should just relax about all of that and first go to the purpose question, the why question. Do I have it right so far, what he said?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the purpose question, yeah.
And, you know, he really stated it very strongly, according to you, the author, the blogger, the person I believe, the person I was counting on, the person who was there to, you know, give me some idea about this guy's thinking. He said, according to you, he said you should pretty much relax about the how am I going to do it and spend a lot of time devoted to the why. He didn't call it the why. You didn't call it the why. He called it the purpose. That's the why, essentially. And to me, and maybe I'm just being defensive to feel this way, but to me, when I go immediately to the how, it is a sign that I'm not resisting, that I've given into it, and now I'm just ready to, you know, implement.
Yes, and it was interesting when I read the book too, because I've always been a how person. I'm a mad applier of things. If I can see, how can I make that work? How can this work? How can that work? The point that I was interested in with him is, and I was transporting myself back in the days when I worked in management roles in government, where there were ideas and things that were coming forth, and my mind would automatically go to the how. How can we make this happen? How will this? How many people will we need? And in asking those how questions, particularly when it was somebody else's idea, you were trying to figure out, can I make this work with all the other things that I've got going on in my life? And it was almost like, in my case, that I was sort of storing up various reasons why it might not happen. So by going back to the core, in terms of the purpose of, what actually matters to us, is this something that's going to be useful to progress what we need to do? It gets people back to square one. I read somebody else's post yesterday in terms of, and I wish I can remember the reference, but it was going along the same lines in terms of really. I think it was Seth Godin. It was one of his recent ones, basically saying you really need to know, get to a point where someone in a situation where ideas are sort of running like this, where a situation, somebody might respond, why are we actually doing this? You know, let's stop, because sometimes people sort of go running in terms of, okay, here's an idea. The boss said it, so we must do it. How can we do it? And we run off, and you're too many miles down the track before somebody suddenly goes, hey, is this actually what matters to us and what our purpose is?
Well, Lynn, would you say, though, that the why approach, what is the purpose, that is more of a proponent of resistance? In other words, are those two authors, assuming it was Seth Godin and Peter Block, Are they encouraging some sort of rational resistance? You know, just invented a new theory or probably not.
Yeah, that's interesting. Oh, yes, I mean, it all comes down to being clear about what you're doing and why you're doing it. And so if you sort of put the come to a view, you can either do this as an individual or from a group perspective. And obviously, in a group perspective, it's a bit more difficult. But it is an interesting question. And the reason I put that together was I usually put things in the blog that I'm sort of grappling with as well, and I find them interesting ideas and something to think about because it's not just the same old, same old. And one of the reasons I started writing a blog was to get some clarity for myself about my practice and what I'm doing, and to also to keep my writing skills active, and that's all sorts of reasons. And it's been a wonderful experience because you're actually on the hunt for ideas and seeing people's views being expressed very actively and passionately. I really enjoy it.
Well, it really is fun to be able to know someone in a whole nother dimension. You know, it's a very important aspect of our social media friendships because you know someone on their blog a lot differently than you know them on Twitter, you know, and certainly when they have the opportunity to hear you on Women Are Not Funny Radio, they get to know you in an entirely different way. So tell me, Lynn, I told you some little known, I shared with you some very fascinating little known facts about Australia. What little known facts, and, you know, they could actually be well-known facts that I would be unaware of. What should we know about Australia, those of us who have not had the good fortune to travel there yet?
Oh, goodness me. What should you know? You should know that much like Americans, you will be welcomed, a very hospitable bunch of people we are. You should know
Do you find Americans friendly when you travel here?
Absolutely, yes.
You do?
Yes, most so.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
Extremely helpful, and you know, all you got to do is stand on a street corner with a map on, as I did in Chicago a year or so ago when it was freezing cold, and the number of people who will come up and want to assist you was very, very lovely. You should know that Australians have much less respect for authority than Americans do, in my humble opinion. So we're more likely to be a little bit cynical, and that can be a good thing, and it can sometimes be not so good thing. But yes, be prepared to... As you do so well, be made fun of and make fun of, but it's in the nicest it's in the nicest possible way. But it can sometimes take people aback when they first come across it. And it's a vast and different place. Even within the city of Sydney where I live, there are so many different experiences to be had. And then if you take yourself out into the outback, in the centre of the country, you can never feel so so alone in a wonderful way in such remote places. So similar to the size of your country, but with only a population of 22 million compared to I think something like 307 or 310 million in your country. So we are coast huggers. Because our internal parts of the country aren't as hospitable and habitable as your inland.
Well, Lynn, you have two daughters who are starting their careers. Do you anticipate that they are going to stay in Australia?
I truly believe that neither of them will. In fact, one of them is planning a trip to Africa in January, and she may well be away for 6 months. It's her second trip to Kenya. She's been to Ghana. She's all of 22 years old, and I don't know, something we did when they were 4 and 6 years old set off a bug when we took them on their first trip to Indonesia. Our other daughter may well end up living in Japan next year. So it's truly a global experience growing up in the time that they're growing up. There are no borders, and it gives me great hope.
Yeah, well, you have certainly set a striking example for them. And now, you know, now you can pay in loneliness and worry and concern when you send a 22-year-old daughter off by herself to Africa, which is, you know, I think it's very cool, but I also think as a parent it's probably very difficult to do. And I understand that you're not sending her, you know, that she's free agent on her own.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, I misspoke there if the daughter is listening. But you know, I think it's very they're very fortunate to have parents who have enjoyed global lifestyle, because it does make it that much more open to them. Lynn, you have just been a fabulous guest, and I do appreciate your willingness to let me make fun of you for being so elderly. I mean, I know it's something you can't help. It's beyond your control. Your birthday happened when it did, and you've been a very good sport about that. You probably have been drinking some sort of tonic during this call, you know, just to help you get through. But whatever you've done, I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for coming today.